host. She'll tell you what to do, explaining all the things, no matter what tomorrow brings. Let's answer all the questions. Let's Jamie's our host. She's bursting with style. When she needs a little boost, she'll call her co-host Miles. Explaining all the things, no matter what tomorrow brings. Let's answer all the questions. Let's explaining all the things.
Hi, friends. Welcome to season 3, episode 5 of our special episode talking about higher level thinking. I know everyone's very excited about talking about this. We are joined, as always, by my co-host.
Hey, everyone.
Who is Miles Mancini. Great job. I'm Jamie Wilson. And our special guest is Dr. Glenn Whitehouse.
Hi.
Great. Thanks, guys, so much for giving me all of that feedback. Dr. Glenn Whitehouse, can you introduce yourself for us?
Sure. Yeah. I am Glenn Whitehouse here at FGCU. I am the Director of Core Skills, which is kind of a made-up title, and we can talk about what that is later. Mm-hmm. But I'm also a faculty member in philosophy. I've been here at FGCU since FGCU opened in 1997, so I'm actually a year one faculty member. And not for nothing, but I have both of you as students.
Yes. I have known Dr. Whitehouse since 1999, and you were probably 1998?
I think so, yeah.
So we go way back. We are friends from a long time ago.
Way back machine.
Philosophy is one of the core courses that we took with you. Martin Buber was a big influence on our lives, obviously. If you don't know who Martin Buber
on our
is,
lives.
I lived and breathed Martin Buber for a long time. And we have kind of transversed this sort of relationship with you as we were your students. Now we are co-faculty members with you, and we recently were cohort members for your cohort. Can you tell us about your cohort, what that entails?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So one of the projects that I do here at FGCU is a project that's dedicated towards helping students earn skill badges for what we call transferable skills. So a transferable skill would be something like critical thinking or oral communication or teamwork. You know, those are all skills that you apply in a lot of different contexts. That's what the transferable part means. Mm-hmm. They don't belong to one particular job or one particular academic discipline. They're things that you use all over the place. So part of that project was to help faculty members create assignments that would build those skills and embed them right into regular classes as just regular class assignments. So that was the purpose of the cohort. So the one that the two of you were in was kind of a specialized version of that within the Pages program. The Pages program is a career program specifically for humanities and social science majors in the College of Arts and Sciences. So you, along with, I think, faculty members from the humanities and social science disciplines gathered together, worked on a lot of different things, but one of the things you did was create an assignment that would work in one of your classes and would help students build some of these core skills and also be able to document them for the purposes of getting a badge and thereby getting some recognition for them.
Yeah.
Now, when you say badging, for people who are not familiar with that, is that like a physical Girl Scout badge? Like, are we wearing the badge to, you know, mixers, or is the badge look different?
I'm so glad you asked.
You're welcome.
the answer is yes and no. So the main way that the student gets this badge is in electronic form. So it's going to come as basically it's a digital badge. So it's something that you can park, for instance, on your LinkedIn profile or on other kinds of professional sites like Indeed that people use to get look for jobs, or you can send it directly to an employer. It is an electronic component that you can use in various ways online. And again, kind of the purpose of that is to give people recognition for some of these skills, transferable skills. Like one of our skills is teamwork, right? Mm-hmm. Teamwork's really important in the job world. It's really important to employers that people can work well in teams. But you're never going to major in teamwork.
Right.
You're never
going
to take a class that's in teamwork, right? Yeah. Part of the idea behind these badges is to give people some recognition for these skills that are a huge part of your education and are incredibly important in the working world, but they're not directly part of your transcript because they're not the name of a course, right? So that's the idea. So yes, the main way this is going to come out is in electronic form, and that has a lot of benefits because it helps employers search for you when they're mm-hmm. doing electronic searches. However, and I know this is a issue, and I know
I'm so excited.
You particularly be excited about this. but we are also going to have actual embroidered badges and actual sashes that people can have.
For graduation.
For graduation bling.
Yes.
Because we did student focus groups, and we asked the people, and the people told us.
People want badges.
The people said, I want to walk across the stage with so much bling that I can't walk.
Yes.
And that is in fact, what we're going to do.
There's a movie with the stinking badges. I can't remember that movie.
Blazing Saddles.
Okay, but I love a badge. Okay. So today's focus of what the students have read and what we want to talk about is the idea of higher level thinking, critical thinking, and I know that we can get a badge in critical thinking. Because students, like you said, are not maybe taking a class on critical thinking.
Right.
And so we want them to be able to flex this muscle, because for some times we've kind of beat this out of them for a long time. And we were talking about this before you came, is this idea that we're not really teaching that as a skill sometimes. They're taught to like memorize the information and then regurgitate it. So why is critical thinking so important?
Yeah, that's really a great question, and I'm glad you framed it that way, because I do kind of feel like a lot of times the kinds of learning, especially maybe that we get in high school or middle school, a lot of times there is a missing critical thinking component of it. And I'll just give an example. I know I'm seeing people in this room, but I know the people listening to the podcast can't hear, but I'll ask for a show of hands anyway, and if you're not in this room, tough for you. What I recall when I was in school, like elementary school, middle school, high school, several times I got these like little assignments that said, I'm going to give a statement, and I'm going to have to decide whether it's a fact or an opinion. Did any of you have assignments like this? All right, that I think, I even remember these were identified as critical thinking assignments, separating fact from opinion. Here's the problem with that. It makes you think like there are only facts and opinions, but that is almost certainly not true. An opinion would be something like, what's the best flavor of ice cream, right? A fact would be the freezing point of water is 32 degrees Fahrenheit, right? That's a fact. That's a fact and an opinion. Mm-hmm. But what's a better form of government, a democracy or having a king? Mm-hmm. So. That's not ice cream,
right.
And it's also not the boiling point of water. And to say that the answer to that question is just an opinion, I think doesn't do justice to the stakes of that kind of argument. All these things that we do, political arguments, legal arguments, arguments about the best course of action for an organization, a company, a nonprofit, anything. Those are all things where we bring to light reasons and evidence. They're not the same as like a strictly factual argument, and they're not the same as an opinion either. That's the space where critical thinking comes in. And again, I think, unfortunately, we do tend to skip past that a lot of times in school. Sure. And I think that's something, if all you came in school was the fact and opinion survey, I think college is the time to fill in the gap between those two things.
Yeah, totally.
Nice.
We have a question from Michaela, because her question has to do with critical thinking, and I know we're going to get into other things, but let's not forget hers.
Hi, I'm Michaela. My question is, on slide 25, critical thinking, it says, thinking creatively involves looking outside the box to imagine other packages containing different content. Schoolwork can make students begin to think more creatively. In what ways do you as professors incorporate work that encourages students to think outside the box?
So creative and critical thinking, are they the same, do you think?
I actually don't think they're the same.
That's fine.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't think so either.
And they're not defined that way either.
Yeah, I think that one comes into play in creative thinking is creating something new, right? So if I'm creating something new, that could take a number of different forms. So maybe I'm writing a song, and you know, I think it would be naive to think that that's completely, you know, like songs don't just come down from heaven. Like
there's
a myth of the genius. There's a process, and you might be going off of material from another song that you know, or if you're a blues musician, you might be going off a standard set of phrases and putting them together in a new way, something like that. You know, using existing material, existing genres, existing traditional material to create something new. Like, to me, that's creative thinking. I think you can do critical thinking without that creative component. Mm-hmm. Like I think you can think critically about something that is just given to you that you didn't produce, but you have to analyze it. So I think, to me, that's where I would put the distinction between them, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think So do you see, because I think going back to Michaela's question, the idea that, you know, how do we as teachers incorporate that into the classroom, creative thinking or mm-hmm. critical thinking, either or both, how we want to look at it?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So why don't we go with the creative thinking part? I think that something that's really important to get out of your education is the capacity to be able to actually do something, like to actually apply things, right? So I think it's a mistake to treat education as a completely analytical exercise. So like I could learn some logical rules, and if you showed me an argument, I could critique it using those rules. I could tell you where you made a bad step, or this isn't a good definition, or your two thoughts aren't consistent. All those things are valuable, and all those things are part of critical thinking. They don't actually create anything new. And I think one of the outcomes of education is that you should be able to do something with that education. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think one of the ways that a lot of teachers try to do that in the classroom is with things that we think of, that we maybe describe as being active learning. When I think of active learning, I'm not thinking about an exam. I'm not thinking about a homework or a problem set. I'm thinking about a project or a product or a performance. Like, I'm going to do something. I'm going to make something. I'm going to apply what I've learned in this class to something. That's where I really see creativity being taught in classrooms. So, okay, we're going to have whatever the content of this class is. Then you're going to go apply it out in the real world, or then you're going to create your own product or do something with that knowledge. Right. That, I think, is a good way to put creativity into a classroom.
Yeah, I think there's a place right for both, because if you're creating something or being asked to create something, work on a group project, whatever it happens to be, the critical thinking then can be the part that analyzes what's working or not working within that project, right? I mean, the thing that works well or the thing that needs to be improved upon. I think that's ideally what we want to ask students to do, is they take something creative, whether they've created it or not, but then apply that critical lens to what's working there, what's not working there. So I know we do this on a lot of the group projects, whether we've done with the podcast before. I've done it with the film projects before, where students create films. They're not film students, but they're creating that, and then they're seeing what works, what doesn't work, why doesn't it work, that kind of thing.
I think a couple areas, I think going back to the transferable skills, because if you're in a job interview or a student is graduating and they have to explain, hey, I'm a critical thinker. Like, how are you a critical thinker? Give me an example of a time where you had to think critically or creatively and solve a problem. Yeah. I think if you're able to do that and have the language to do that, and I think also teaching students to see problems or situations from multiple perspectives, because we can really focus in on our one perspective. Before you came, we were talking with the students about what confirmation bias is, and allowing students to see a problem from multiple perspectives can really kind of prevent that confirmation bias. So if a student wants to do a transferable skills in critical thinking, what are some kind of muscles they have to flex in order to prove that they can do that type of thinking?
Yeah, that's a great question. And if I'd been better prepared, I would have read the rubric for that skill before
I came here. I don't remember it either.
In fact, I did not. well, here's I guess what I would say. So, I mean, I think that you know, critical thinking is actually probably the toughest of all those skills. When we think about transferable skills, critical thinking is probably the toughest of all of them to actually define what it is. And I think one of the reasons why that is because each discipline or each area of practice has kind of its own methodological rules for how to, like, you know, there's mathematics in ways is one form of critical thinking that you're using as a basis for all kinds of STEM procedures. Right. Logic is another one that you're using for all kinds of argumentative disciplines. So there's a lot of different kind of things that you could identify as critical thinking within particular disciplines. I guess a way to generalize it out would be to think about, okay, what kind of process or method am I putting on something when I have a project? I guess would be good. Like, so I would say, so let's say I'm doing a project, you know, and my assignment is to make a podcast, to go to a random one, or to do whatever, or I'm going to make a film, or I'm going to do whatever it is. That's not just a process of saying, hey, you're going to do this thing, have at it, right? Just go, right? Well, that's going to have results that are, I will not say are bad, but are, let us say, random, right? What really helps you actually do a project is to think about it, plan for it beforehand, and critique it afterwards, right? So if I'm going to be a good filmmaker or a good podcaster or a good writer or whatever, a good engineer, what I'm going to do is I'm going to approach that process kind of deliberately and methodically and analytically before I do it, and I'm going to reflect on it afterwards. Right. And so, you know, a lot of times the place to look for the places where you applied critical thinking is, again, let's say you have a big project, this is for a course mm-hmm. or something. I'm going to look for the places where I did the planning. You know, mm-hmm. if you're a good planner, you're thinking through what the different options are. Within those different options, you are, and actually just knowing what the different options are is an exercise in critical mm-hmm. thinking. Right. And to understand, okay, if I'm going to tackle this problem, there's basically three major ways of doing it. I have to pick what those are. And the way I'm going to do that is sort of think through the strengths and weaknesses of all of them. I'm going to make an informed choice about what the trade-offs are between all those three different approaches, and I'm going to decide which one I'm going to run with. Then, second step, I'm going to take that big idea and I'm going to turn it into procedural steps. Like, I have to go from the big idea to figuring out how I'm actually going to exercise it, mm-hmm. and that's going to be sort of an exercise of practical reason or planning things out. And then after I actually do it, I'm going to go back and reflect on that and say to myself, okay, what was the goal I had for this project, and then what actually happened?
Right.
And then if I had to do this over again, or the next time I do this, what would I change, you know, in order right. to make that work? So I think that is an example which, you know, can be applied to almost any kind of project. That's critical thinking sure. embedded into a larger process sure. of doing a project. And so as long as you have something where you're doing those planning things ahead of time and those reflective things afterwards, then that's a good example. And I would also say it's incredibly important to take those things seriously, right? Mm-hmm. Can I say ass on this podcast?
Sure,
you can.
There are no rules.
Those are the things you shouldn't have asked, right? Like, right. I think they're actually incredibly important, because that's the thing that allows you the next time you do something to not make the same mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. And so, or even if you didn't make mistakes, to make it better, to make right. it iteratively better, one instance to another. So I think if you're thinking about how to document your process for critical thinking, that's a good place to do it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that speaks to, I know in the reading they were talking about how the differences mm-hmm. in the reading between critical thinking and creative thinking, the idea of thinking outside the box versus looking within the box, right,
mm-hmm.
to
right.
see. And that's what you're essentially describing, those yeah. parts of the process.
So critical thinking is in the box?
In the box, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's something fair. I think there's something fair about that. So I think that one of the things that it's easy to sometimes think of critical thinking as being completely analytical.
Mm-hmm.
And in a certain sense it is. Like, if you're performing critical thinking, you're mastering a certain set of rules, and maybe it's a general set of rules, just like logic, right? Or maybe it's a specific set of rules to one discipline, like the axioms of geometry or something like that. But you master that set of rules, you can perform a new problem within them. And that's, you know, like that's the box, right?
Mm-hmm.
If the box is
right.
Euclid's geometry, I can solve any geometrical problem if I know
right.
the axioms and the theorems. That's an exercise in critical thinking.
Right.
If I know logic, I can analyze whether your argument is consistent, you know, or you know, whether it's a sound argument or not. I can do all those things, and to do that, I'm kind of mastering a general system of rules, and I'm applying those rules to a new case.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily create anything new,
right.
but it does sort of exercise, I guess, quality. That's quality. It's a very important
sure.
exercise in quality control, right?
Right.
Because you should be consistent. You should be.
Right.
You should be producing things that are sound within whatever
right.
within whatever system you're operating. You should be producing things that are actually feasible and practical. So it's important to know those rules, but that's not the same thing as creating something new, I guess. Yeah.
Before we get to Marissa's question,
mm-hmm.
One of my favorite stories that you tell is that philosophy major working for your dad writing a paper or something. And I remember you brought up this really good point, and I tell this story all the time, because you were saying, I'm a good writer. I'm a good researcher. I'm a good writer.
Do you want me to just tell the story?
Yes,
okay.
Yes. So,
okay.
And I think about
all right.
that all
yeah.
the time, because
okay.
I think it applies to so many people listening to
yeah.
that.
Yeah, sure, yeah. So this is something that happened to me when I was in college, and I used to go home and have a summer job. You know, so I'd go home, have a summer job, go back to college at the end. And one summer I was working at there's a research park at UCF, and I worked in a firm that was in that research park. And it was called the Institute for Simulation and Training. And they were a company that made basically training programs for the Department of Defense and for fire departments.
I don't know how this was your summer job. Like, I was
yeah.
I got people out of the pool for my summer job.
Yeah.
That was
well,
me. You were working for the Department
well,
of Defense.
It's no, I wasn't. I was working for this. Anyway, it's
training the people for the Department.
It's a long story, but anyway, so I, you know, this was my summer job, and I was in college, right? I was in college. I was majoring in philosophy. And I walked into this room, into this Institute for Simulation and Training, and when I got there on the first day, myself and the receptionist were literally the only people in the whole institution that were not engineers. Everybody else was an engineer.
I bet you that was a fun time.
Yeah, everybody else was an engineer except for me and the receptionist. And so I walked in there. I don't think they really knew what to do with me. But the other part of this is that not only was everybody an engineer, but my father was the dean of engineering at UCF right next door to this place, right? Okay. So they all knew my dad. Everybody knew my dad. Everybody loves my dad, right? So I came in, and for the first week I was there, my name was Gary's son, and they just paraded me around office to office.
Gary's son.
Some
strange, he's so smart.
Yeah, though they didn't say that. And they said, this is Gary's son. Have you met Gary's son? And so forth. And after a week of that, I was kind of ready to quit. But and also to understand, I think that if you say that you're majoring in philosophy and if you're a room full of engineers, they're not necessarily impressed by that because, I think engineers are very smart, but it's a numbers kind of smart.
Yes.
And they may not always understand that there's a words kind of smart as well, and that's kind of what the philosophy major, the English major mm-hmm. has, but that's not the domain. This was all engineers. And so, again, I was about ready to quit and go find another summer job. But at the end of that first week, the director of this place comes to me and he says, I have this job I think you might be interested in doing. We have to write this report that explains what we do here at the Institute for granting agencies and for government funding and all these kinds of things that tie in to help getting money into this place. Do you think you could do this? And this was a project that obviously was kind of important to the organization, but none of the engineers wanted to do it because it was words, right? Because it was words, not numbers, right? So basically, they gave it to me, and I didn't know anything about the specifics of what they were doing, but I mean, at that point, it was my junior year in college. The summer after my junior year, I'd done so many term papers, many term papers, many research papers. I knew how to write, I knew how to do research on a new field. I knew how to learn, right? Mm-hmm. And so I just dug right into that. I interviewed everybody in the Institute. I read their articles. I looked at write-ups of what they did. I looked at journals. I even went over to the economics department at UCF and had them tell me how to write an economic impact report of the wider impact of their research.
Again, you as a summer student, it's just blowing my mind. But go ahead, keep going. So smart.
So I do this. I do this all summer. Again, I'm not an expert in any of this stuff, but I write it up. I hand it to the director at the end of the summer. I go back to college. And later that fall, I'm back in Orlando for a week, and I go to a UCF football game with my father. We happen to be sitting right in front of the director, the guy who had been my boss. And he turns back, we say hello, and he turns to his wife, and he says, oh, this is Gary Whitehouse. His son, Glenn, here wrote that report I told you about, right? And this is after my summer of being Gary's son, right?
Yeah.
So I say that, not just because it's a funny story, but, what I didn't realize at that time was that actually became the story of my entire career. I went to graduate school. I came here as a philosophy professor. I was a philosophy professor for a long time, but I kept getting pulled into administrative tasks. And that's because the reason why that was is because a lot of times in the meeting, I was maybe the person who made a comment or wrote the notes or synthesized what other people said. People sort of started to count on me for coming up with a compromise position or synthesizing the point of a meeting, something like that. That's what led me to be asked to become first the chair and then the associate dean and then the job I have now. And so all of that came from just exercising general critical thinking and communication mm-hmm. skills. That's mm-hmm. really it. And I never studied administration. I don't think there is such a thing. I never studied administration. But administration is just another word for management. Administrator is just another word for manager. I never studied management or anything like that. But what I found was that those skills, which I just think of as philosophy skills, I thought, synthesizing somebody's arguments, that's philosophy. Writing clearly, that's philosophy. I now know that that's a transferable skill that's not just for philosophy. But at the time, I just thought this is what I took in school. What I found was that it was actually incredibly applicable to everything I do. And even though I'm not a philosophy professor anymore, I use those skills every day. I use those skills I learned in school every single day to communicate things, to plan things, to sort of figure out what the options are, to analyze things and sort of think through the evidence, know what to say to people. Sure. So I think to me, that story just kind of encapsulates so how powerful those kinds of general skills are, and in many ways how they can be more powerful mm-hmm. than your major even. You know, because yeah. in a lot of ways, what made me successful there had nothing to do with what I majored in so much. It was what I could do. Mm-hmm. And right. I think that's really been the case in my career of going from faculty to administration. It's also what I can do. It's not the specifics of what I studied.
Sure.
Marissa has a question for us about mm-hmm. balanced thinking.
Sure.
Hi, I'm Marissa. On balanced thinking, it says, when we seek out and carefully consider arguments for and against a particular position, we're engaging in balanced thinking. What are some ways you see balancing thinking in your everyday life routine?
Okay, great. So, yeah, that's a good question. So I think that the operative word in what you just said was carefully consider, right? Because all the time, every day, we're dealing with people who don't disagree with us. You know, we can do that in our daily lives. We can do it by, you know, turning on the TV or the radio or the podcast. We can always hear people who say something we disagree with, right? And I think the initial reaction to that is just to react. It's to say, oh, you agree with me, yay. You disagree with me, boo, right? That's kind of a very basic reaction, but that's not carefully considering something, right? So I think the place where just reacting or the place where just having an opposition is different than critical thinking is when you get into that careful consideration piece. Like, so careful consideration would be if I can go away, if I can move past the yay and the boo, right? And I can start to understand what you're saying to say, okay, I actually agree with the conclusion that you're saying, but I don't agree with how you got there. Like, I actually think there's a better argument. At that point, I'm starting to carefully consider. You're saying, okay, I'm not just going to say, oh, great, we're best friends now because we agree, right? I'm going to say, okay, I know that you have this argument, and I agree actually with the conclusion of that argument, but maybe I don't think some of your sources are credible, or maybe I don't think your argument is consistent. And then that, like, is a step toward carefully considering. Or maybe I disagree with you, but I actually think you made some good points, and I can talk about what those good points are. You know, I think that's where you get from that stage of simply reacting, which people do all the time, right, to actually carefully considering something, which, you know, I think it's important because for a couple of reasons. One, I think just when we talk about argument, like argument is one of those words I think that has become ambiguous in our society. Like, at one level, an argument is just a fight, right? At another level, it's like a considered set of reasons for a conclusion. And I think argument in the sense of fight, our society is tearing itself apart over those. Like, just yeah. I mean, we are tearing ourselves mm-hmm. apart, yelling at each other over things we disagree with. But I think to actually, you don't have to agree with somebody to respect them, but to respect their reasons, right? To actually sort of sit through, carefully consider their reasons, acknowledge their good points when they exist, and think about ways that you can make people agree with, that you can actually help their arguments and make it better. That not only sort of increases the quality of the argument, it also is just a fundamental gesture of respect towards people, and I think that's really yeah. important if we're going to have actual dialogue and not just war, you know, just not yeah. just like a verbal combat.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we're missing that, though, right? I mean, I think maybe this is just a reminiscing of something that doesn't really exist, but I do feel like there's a time. I know personally, I feel like I've become very attracted to people that I disagree with profoundly, but if they can put together a really interesting, well-reasoned argument, and I respect their reasons, I feel very drawn to them. Even like, I don't like your conclusion, but sure. I may not vote for you or something like that, but I really like the way you put all of that together.
Thought process
that's really
it.
Interesting. Yep. And I don't know, I feel like that's sort of a lost art today, where we just vilify everyone immediately. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know.
Well, I always say with Miles, being married to Miles, I'm not married to Miles. I just want to.
Can you clarify that?
And I'm thinking about you. I'm also not married to Glenn Whitehouse, but I'm thinking about that because I'm married to an analytical person who is a numbers person. I am a words person, right? When you argue, you are very much Miles. I'm talking to Miles, a devil's advocate. You love that. Like, love, he loves to spar, even if he doesn't even agree with you, he'll just be like, well, what about this, right? Like, you just like the mind Olympics.
Yes.
When you argue with your wife, not argue, maybe that when you have a disagreement with your wife.
We're getting really personal.
Is that how you think? Or you think like a philosopher? Like, are you really want to listen to her conclusion? Because I find this so fascinating. Like, I feel like we're on a relationship podcast now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you a good person to argue with?
So let me just say, you have to be in a marriage.
Yes.
If you have to be really careful about when to bring out the philosophy chops.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Because things can go south really quickly. So yeah. like here's some things that spouses don't particularly appreciate. So I could come out in the morning, and my wife could say something like, "Oh, your socks don't match." I'm like, "Well, what do you mean? They're both socks."
That would send me over the edge, Glenn. I'd be like, right. I haven't had coffee and I can't talk
those
to you
kinds
about
of,
this.
Those kinds of things, while logically sound,
yes.
are generally not appreciated. But no, I think that I am analytical.
Yeah.
I do spend a lot of time with my spouse analyzing things. It's generally other people, though, not us.
Yeah, just for funsies.
Just for funsies, or as the debrief to the day, as the postmortem to our respective work days. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yes. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. It also gets you into trouble with your children as well. At least I've found it's very hard sometimes to approach some of those issues that are brought up, whether it's just kind of removing your bias. Also, something too I wanted to bring up that relates. We've read about so many different fallacies. I know that's a big part of philosophy, understanding all of the fallacious reasoning, that kind of stuff. There's a lot of fallacies out there. And it seems like as we're reading through all those fallacies, we all use them all the time. So sure. What do we do? Even if someone's engaging in some of those pretty cliched, fallacies, ad hominem attacks and all that, but it seems like that's the way we win arguments, not we necessarily, or we see people out there doing this. How do you respond to that, since it seems like we just fallacies?
And you've talked about fallacies in this
We've read a little bit the big ones, the straw man's ad hominems, that kind of thing.
Yeah, sure. So, I think that, fallacies are kind of the fouls of reasoning, right? So it's kind of like basketball. You have, you hit somebody, it's a foul, right? So, I think you can always point those things out. I think sometimes that's effective and sometimes it isn't. I think a lot of times when people commit fallacies, right, they commit fallacies because they believe that those things have rhetorical effect. So anytime you talk, there's a logical, or anytime you make an argument, there's a logical aspect to it and there's a rhetorical aspect to it, right? So you're both trying to say something that's true, but you're also trying to do things that are persuasive to the audience. And sometimes it's those efforts to persuade that can sometimes lead people to push things over the line. So I believe, if I'm disagreeing with you and I can damage your credibility as a speaker, then the audience is going to be more likely to agree with me. And so I say something that attacks you instead of your argument. That's ad hominem, right? I think that oftentimes it can help to point that out, but I think it's useful. You have to be a little bit diplomatic when you do it, to be honest. Find ways to direct attention back to the argument, I don't think there's anything, there's nothing wrong with trying to be persuasive. And like you said, there are times when we do cross those lines, and there's times when we try to persuade people rhetorically, that's true. The bad part comes when it's all rhetoric, when you're just trying to, win.
I think back to your class, one of the things I probably became obsessed with when I was a student, which I hadn't been obsessed with since I was a little kid, and then you got me back into it, was wrestling. Because you presented that when we were really, I think we were reading Ong at that point, we were talking about orality and literacy, and just the way that all of the improvisational speech, kind of stuff that would happen with the rhetoric regarding the large audiences, and that's a whole thing. And that's become not just in wrestling. I know you're smiling, why are we talking about professional wrestling?
I don't remember wrestling at all from any of your classes.
He showed multiple clips from WWE at the time.
I don't remember this.
You remember this, right?
I remember it. Well, so this wasn't in the version of the class you taught?
I don't think so.
Okay, we were reading Walter Ong's Orality and Literacy.
Yes, I remember that.
Okay, you know how he talked about the Homer's poems all the time?
Yes.
Right. So I guess the point I was trying to make in the version that Miles took was that a lot of those same characteristics that are associated with ancient, like the heroes in the ancient poems, like the Odyssey and the Iliad, are things that you see in professional wrestling all the time. They spend all their time bragging and insulting their opponents. I mean, it's very much like, if you read the Iliad, it's very much like a professional wrestling broadcast with a really good script writer. I mean, essentially that's what it is,
it
right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I think, like, that's an example of this sort of hyper-aggressive kind of rhetoric. This is what you see a lot in politics now.
Right.
That's what I mean, yeah.
And the problem is that if it's nothing but that, if it's nothing but bragging and insults, right, then it becomes just an exercise in trying to not persuade but to win, right? To win by degrading your opponent, to win by getting the audience so fired up that they'll believe anything you say. Those kinds of things aren't they're not constructive, right? They're mm-hmm. constructive. It's okay to inspire your audience, right? It's okay to maybe point out some things that might lead them to want to take what the opponent says with a grain mm-hmm. of salt, right? But it's not okay to make that the only content of what you say. You have to actually wed it to an actual argument mm-hmm. that
facts.
An actual argument that a reasonable person, a reasonable person could agree with, right? Like I think one standard that some people sometimes use is that we all know we're not all going to agree, but if you can present your arguments in a form that any person could agree with them, like if you present reasons that are, I guess, universal enough and rational enough that any person could, in principle, agree with them, that's something that has at least the potential for rationality. Mm-hmm. So, there's no rational argument that leads to, if I just say, you're for Ohio State and I'm for Michigan, Ohio State sucks. That's it, right? Like, if all I'm going to proceed from is those kinds of like parochial loyalties, like to this particular football mm-hmm. tribe, right? There's no getting beyond that, right? Mm-hmm. But if I can, in an argument, present reasons that you could at least could agree with, then that's again a mark of respect for you as somebody I'm talking to. But it's also sort of I'm offering those reasons as a public, in a public way. And I think when we talk about rationality, mm-hmm. the act of rationality is offering reasons to people, right? The act of rationality is I don't just yell at you or I don't just, hit you in the head to get you to do what I want you to do. I actually offer you a reason.
That's
actually what it means to be rational, right? Is to actually offer reasons and to be able to evaluate them.
So we've talked about creative thinking. We've talked about mm-hmm. balanced thinking. We have multidimensional thinking now.
In the section of multidimensional thinking, it states, when you view yourself and the world around you from different perspectives or vantage points to gain a comprehensive perspective, you're engaging in multidimensional thinking. What if someone finds themselves struggling to make decisions or approach a new situation because they are overwhelmed by the many perspectives they would have to consider? How could someone get around this particular indecision?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's a really interesting observation. I think this is an issue. I think that a lot of students get into when they're in college, frankly, because I refer to this as the intro to philosophy problem. Because you're introduced and you start reading these different thinkers, and you're like, oh, this is great. This person's really persuasive. This person's really smart. I agree with what this person says. And then you get to the very next reading. And that person says something else, but they're also very very insightful and very smart, and they give it a good argument. And all of a sudden, you find yourself agreeing with six different things you read, but they're not compatible with each other. They say different things, right? So, I think that could get to a point of indecision. And I think what you're saying, I think, is really, I think it's actually a really important dimension of critical thinking. Is that are you familiar with the phrase analysis paralysis?
So
that's the idea that you can analyze something so much that you can't bring yourself to make a decision about it because every option you come up with has a downside and then you can't decide, right? That can also be true when you sort of learn different viewpoints or learn different theories or look at different authors. You can become so at first you're so overwhelmed by how awesome they are, then when you get learn a little more critical thinking, then you start criticizing them, then you start looking for the logical flaws and the inconsistencies, and you can very easily go to these six people are all awesome to these people all suck, right? They're all equally wrong, and I can't decide between them. And so I think it's really important that we don't just exercise our critical capacities to analyze something to death, or to bring it to the point where we get to the point where we're just saying, okay, all these different ideas are contradictory, so therefore none of them can be right, and so nothing is right, right? There's a slippery slope from being analytical to sort of almost being getting to the point where you don't believe anything is true because everything has a downside, right? Mm-hmm. So I do think it's really, really important to exercise your critical thinking capacities in a constructive way and not just tearing everything down, right? So I do think anytime I teach a class in philosophy or something, like, I always try to make this point. Critical thinking in philosophy anyway, it isn't just about critiquing arguments or tearing arguments down. It's also about building new ones, right? Mm-hmm. And I think to get to that point where you can understand that any argument is going to have a flaw and a downside, including yours, mm-hmm. right? But to get to the point where you can still have the confidence to put out the best argument you can come up with, to test it in the best and most honest way that you know how against competing perspectives, to improve it by that process of sort of thinking through what the other side is, and then still put it out in the world as a proposition for what's true. Mm-hmm. I think that is really the end point of critical thinking. I think it's a mistake. I think sometimes when we treat it in a completely analytic treat it in a way that leads to that kind of paralysis, that kind of paralysis of just being stuck in all the different variations and not being able to see one of them as being persuasive.
Okay. So we have a game to play with you.
Okay.
But before we do that, I want you to plug Transferable Skills Badging for freshmen.
Yeah, I will go with that.
So they know how to find it and what to do, and then we get to play our game.
Awesome. All right. So the Transferable Skill Badging program at FGCU, as I said, it's a way for you to get recognition and visibility for some of the general skills that you're learning throughout your education. Skills that are not going to appear in your transcript because they're not the name of a course. So again, critical thinking, teamwork, oral communication, written communication, those are some of the things that we badge. So each one of those badges is composed of two components. There's a portfolio and an interview. And so in the portfolio, what students are going to do is gather artifacts from their assignments, from their things that they've done in class. And so you're going to pick out some assignment that you've done in a course, maybe it's a project or something like that, and you're going to say, oh, this is a really good example of me exercising my oral communication skills. So you'll take that and you'll put it in the portfolio. The portfolio lives in a Canvas course. And you're going to put that artifact in there. It's going to be some kind of artifact, some part of the assignment. And then along with that, I'm going to write like a very brief essay, like 250 to 500 words, just a little reflection piece that's going to explain how that thing I did in class is a good example of the skill. And there'll be a rubric to explain what the skill is. So I have to do at least three of those in my portfolio, three of them in three different classes. And then when I'm done doing that, I say, okay, I want my portfolio to be evaluated now. You press a button within the Canvas course, and then somebody evaluates. So that's it might be me. It might be somebody else. And then what happens then is then we'll say either you're done. I mean, either this is okay and you go on to the interview, or not yet, and here's some suggestions for what you could change. If we put you through to the interview, then the second stage is the interview. And the idea of the interview is for you to be able to articulate your skill set in a form that would be useful in a job interview, essentially. So we're basically trying to help students learn how to talk about their own skill set to somebody who's not their professor, to somebody who's not a specialist maybe in their major, to the kind of person who might be the person hiring them after they get out of college, right? Because I think what's really powerful in an interview is a story. You know, like, let me tell you about this cool thing I did in my class, and that's going to be my example of how I worked in a team, and our team had this problem, but we overcame it in this way. It becomes those kinds of stories can be really rich to explain to an employer, you know, why you would make a good employee, why you have these kinds of skills that every employer is looking for. So the second stage of that badge is that interview. You pass the portfolio, you pass the interview, you get the badge. Again, as I said, the badge comes to you in electronic format. You can put it on your LinkedIn, you can I'll put it on Indeed, send it to an employer. And there's, I guess, two payoffs to it. One is that those badges help you get found by employers, because a lot of times employers use searches, and so they'll put it like an entire job ad into a search engine. And so if the job ad says we need people with good teamwork skills, and if you have a badge called teamwork, that's going to help them find you. And the other thing is that the process of getting the badge itself is going to turn you into a better interviewer. So mm-hmm. Once you meet that employer, you're going to be the person, hopefully, that stands out amongst other people as the person who can really tell your own story in a compelling way. So that's what the badges are. There's something that you can get. There are things that you can get started on right away. Like I said, normally it's going to take somebody multiple semesters to earn this, because it's three artifacts in the badge. The first one I'll do this semester. Maybe the second one I'll do in a class next semester. You're collecting those things. Once you sign up for one of the badges, you're in that badge course. You don't get kicked out until even after you graduate, like 16 weeks after you graduate. So you have from now until the time you graduate, and even a little bit after that, to finish the badge. Mm-hmm. To sign up, there's really two ways to do that. One of them is just to go to the FGCU Digital Badges website. So that's just www.fgcu.edu/digital-badges. You go on that website, there's a subpage for transferable skill badges, and then each one of the badges, there's a little registration link, and then that'll get you registered for the Canvas course. You go into the Canvas course, that's where you build the portfolio. The second way that you can do that, and I think this is the way a lot of people will encounter it in classes, is that we are working with faculty to embed badgeable assignments right into classes as regular assignments. So it's very possible and very, in fact, probable that before you leave FGCU, some professor is going to say to you, this assignment that we're doing in this class right now is going to be something that you're going to submit towards the blank badge.
Right.
And then that'll be a component of an actual assignment that you do in class. And more we're going to put those kinds of assignments into classes, so that people encounter those badges just in the regular course of what they do at FGCU, like when they're taking classes.
Awesome. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's the game. It's called This or That. I'm going to give you a choice, and you will have to choose this or that. You can tell us the reason behind it.
But you have to make a choice.
But
you
have
can't
to make a choice.
Fudge it like, oh, I want both. It has to be one or the other.
Okay, here we go. You ready?
Yep.
So say a student does not know what major they should have.
Mm-hmm.
I love that your eyes are closed. You're really taking this in. Okay, they don't know what major. They are on the fence about all the things, and they have to choose. Their choices are communication or philosophy. What should they choose?
You are so evil.
I know I am.
This is for the permanent record.
Okay, well, I mean, for me, the answer is philosophy.
Philosophy.
It's a personal choice, because that's what I find compelling and that's what I find interesting. I also think it's a really, versatile major, in the sense that it's like, I think philosophy and math are the most intensive introductions to critical thinking that you can have. Philosophy mm-hmm. on math on the quantitative side, and philosophy on the verbal side. So to me, I find that aspect of them really useful. Oh. But before, I love communication.
I know you do.
You heard him say it. Our major was not versatile.
Apparently. No, I did not.
We took
I believe those were the words that were said.
Are you familiar with the concept of entrapment?
Yes, I am. And I practice that regularly on this podcast.
Okay.
Second question. Boober or Ong?
Oh, Boober, definitely.
Boober, yeah?
I mean, Ong is awesome.
You all don't know who we're talking about, but it's a good time.
Yeah, Walter Ong, the author of the book of Orality and Literacy, is awesome. It'll make you look at especially pop culture in a completely different way. But it will not change your life. Reading Martin Buber will change your life.
Change your life. Okay. Yeah. Last one. I know that in your spare time, you like to dance with your wife.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Salsa or foxtrot? This or that? Is that the hardest?
Oh, that's a hard one. I think you stumped him.
I'm so good.
I will say salsa, even though it's not the one I'm better at. I'm better at foxtrot than salsa, but I like salsa better than foxtrot. It's just that I haven't been doing it as long.
I would pay money to see you salsa dance, Glenn Whitehouse. I would love to watch this. I could just see your gears working in your brain.
I think we should do a dancing with like the FGCU stars.
Yes, and you could play music.
Here are the ones we know. Waltz, tango, foxtrot, rumba, swing, and did I say tango? Waltz, tango, foxtrot, rumba, swing, cha-cha, salsa, Viennese waltz. Those are the ones we know.
What's the hardest?
Can I guess which is the hardest?
Yeah.
Because I have no experience, but I'm just thinking musically and maybe rumba. Is that a hard one?
No, rumba's actually not that bad. Rumba. But I think Foxtrot is pretty hard. I think Tango is challenging. The one I left out is Hustle, which I hate so much that I don't even mention.
Like
it.
Do the Hustle,
it's
that one?
Yeah, it's basically it's like a disco. It's basically kind of disco, but okay. it messes with your head. And I'll explain it. Miles will like this. This is a music thing. So so here's the problem with Hustle. It's okay.
I just love you.
Now we have a Hustle in our head.
All right, no, so this is the problem with the hustle, which is basically disco. The problem is it's if you considered the dance to be one of the instruments, it's a polyrhythm because the music is in 4/4 and the dance is in 3/4.
Oh wow!
And so basically, you're playing Led Zeppelin's Kashmir and trying to dance to it, which, as we all know, is essentially impossible, right? So that's the problem.
I didn't realize the dance was in 3/4.
The dance is in 3/4, wow. So like my head is like, and understand, I played tuba in high school. Like I'm like feet with the beat, right? When you play a rhythm instrument, like to stray from the one and the three is
that
not,
would make sense that that's hard.
So I have no rhythm.
I find it essentially impossible to do that. But what I found is that people like in the dance world who do not have a music background, they're actually better at it.
They're great at it because they're not thinking.
Because they're not thinking. Yeah, they're right. Exactly.
Do the Hustle. Right. That's the music we should have for our outro.
All right. But I'll work on it.
We have this one.
I'll work on
it. Thanks, Glenn, for coming.
Thank you.
As always, it's all good.